We'll now proceed to item, thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Thank you.
We'll proceed to item 17, which is just a short report on where we are with data privacy contracts. And welcome. It's not warm enough here for you. We can turn the heat up.
So. What's going on?
No, is it as bad out there as it is?
We're all taking our jackets off.
Okay. Let's see, Commissioner.
We have Marcia Bohannon, who's our Chief Information Officer and head of our data security efforts, privacy efforts, and also Heidi Dineen, who's our expert from the Attorney General's Office, who's been working on these issues, and we're glad to have an opportunity to give you an update on where we've moved ahead with the privacy components of our contracts, and I'll turn it over to Marcia.
Thank you, Commissioner Asp. Up on the screen, you'll see a brief agenda. This is meant to be just a very quick update on some of the progress that we've made over the last several months. We were here back in June, I believe, and gave you kind of a high level. This is our plan to move forward. So. Within the presentation, we'll have a reminder of the timeline for the third-party contract work, a little bit about where we are on some actual contracts, and then some of the other sort of additional work that we're doing on privacy and security and some of the communications that have been going on. So moving to the timeline, this is, as I mentioned, just a reminder, and just wanted to point out that a couple of dates here, especially if you'll recall the discussion from earlier when we were talking with TS Gold about the encryption at rest, we committed to requiring from all our vendors encryption at rest by the end of this year. TS Gold was unable to do that, but they have committed to June of next year. But that is a requirement that we're placing on all our vendors now. And then the other one I wanted to point out was just the end of the year next year, 12-16, our goal is to have all of the new language, the contract language that we described to you at one of our previous meetings, have that into all of our contracts at that point. So what we're doing is, as a contract or an agreement comes up for renewal.
Dr. Schroeder has a question.
Oh, Marcia, for those of us who just are not techie in this area, talk to me about encrypting and, is that the right word?
Encrypting.
I can't get the word right. Encrypting and unencrypting. I mean, I think there was a conversation earlier. Okay. What does it mean? What are the options? What are the risks? Who does it? Who can undo it? For those of us who just are not quite there.
It's like the German.
Which is most people, so you're not alone.
I know the movie, but.
Encryption basically is a means to. I guess one way to think about it is you're taking the information that you have in front of you and you're turning it into something else, so if somebody goes and looks at it, they can't read it.
Always the same way?
No, there are various ways of doing it. But the key is that if you don't have a particular key or you don't have some specific knowledge or access, you can't make heads or tails out of it. So. Once it's encrypted, if I have a database that's encrypted and you get access to my machine, you can't read it, so you won't be able to see what that data is. We've used the term at rest and in transit, and basically what that means is if it's in a database, for example, CVE has a large data warehouse, and that's where we store data, so that's encrypted at rest. That means that as it's stored, it's encrypted, so somebody else getting access to that wouldn't be able to identify any of the information in it. In transit means that if we're sending it to somebody, so for example, our data collection system, we're collecting data from the districts. Once it's moving from a district to CDE, that data is not legible to anybody else. So there are different ways of doing it from a technology perspective, but it's critical that some best practice method is used in both of those situations.
So if someone wants to do some research on student data, there's a different term probably for taking away the specific identifying pieces and just having either the ACT scores or whatever it is that somebody wants to research and maybe tie to some other program. I'm trying to figure out, and I don't think that's the same thing, right?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I
well, we have the encrypted student information
right
here. Mm-hmm. We've got the code so we can unencrypt it. Mm-hmm. If in fact somebody wants to do some research, somebody wants to tie in, for example, early childhood experiences with how their reading scores are in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Then
how
what
do they do that?
How do they do that in a way that gives us comfort that we still have protected identifiable student data?
Probably the easiest, yeah, you're right, it is slightly different, but if we were to do that particular example, we would send that data encrypted to whomever the parties are. So they're usually CDE analysts or
right
somebody like that. And that data would then be made available to them. We actually use a system that I know few people have heard about, but it doesn't really matter so much how the technology works. But the key on these kinds of things is to identify that you're talking about the same individual.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're talking about really is the matching process. How do we know? Because
there's
Joe Smith, Jay Smith, Jonathan, you know, there's all different names for one individual. So the technology we use focuses on that, the matching process. So once we decide that, if we're using CDHS as an example, as we mentioned earlier, that the data that they've got on that child is we want to match that up with the data we've got, the key is to make sure we're talking about the same student. So once we do use the PII, the identifiable data, to do that, once we do that, we get rid of that. And then
okay
we get rid of that, the identifiable
data. And then you've just got the connection.
You just have the connections, right.
Okay. So that data is still protected.
Yeah. And it stays in a database that's encrypted.
Okay.
So does that help?
Thank you. Well, I'm hoping it helps.
Okay.
Helps me.
Other questions? Yes, Dr. Schiff.
Is it your sense that we have vulnerability as far as how these databases are connected? I mean, the public sure thinks so. I've been reading as much as I possibly can about it. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that we do have vulnerabilities, and I just wondered if you could speak to that and how can we address that. It seems like encryption is a narrow issue, and there's various levels of encryption as far as hackability, and we have limited resources, so we get that. But, I mean, it's the linkage of the data and its ultimate use, either anticipated or existing, that mm-hmm is concerning the public and, I think, the board. What do you have to say about our vulnerabilities in that respect?
Well, I mean, nobody can promise that it's always going to be safe, that nothing is ever going to happen. I mean, I don't think any organization can promise that. What I can say is that we're applying as many practices as we possibly can to ensure that it's safe within our resources. It's not just a technology piece either. It's also the process side of it. So if somebody does want us to share some data with them for a research purpose, we go through a really extensive process of reviewing what the purpose is. I mean, is it adequate? Does it follow FERPA? Does it follow all the laws? And then we have sign-offs. We have risk assessments we do. So there's a... It's the combination of the technology that's housing the data and the process we follow to make sure that the reason is adequate. And if it isn't, we just say no. And it's hard, but we have done that.
But that IRB process is in place for external researchers like universities, yep, or somebody mm-hmm doing a dissertation or something.
Right.
But it doesn't apply to federal agencies or state agencies that want the data. You don't go through IRB with them. So
no,
what do you say to a federal agency that you didn't anticipate would be asking for these data in this format with these linkages, or a state agency that wants to connect? I mean, the protection for a private research project is the IRB process, mm-hmm, but it doesn't exist with an agency at the federal or state level.
we basically go through this, the same process if it's another state agency. I'm not aware of any federal agency asking for identifiable information, I'm not aware of that situation. But state agencies, we would still go through the same process of reviewing it and evaluating whether the research is worth doing that for. And also, the vast majority of these situations are required by some statute. Not all, as I mentioned earlier. But, for example, higher education, we do share data with them, and there are some very distinct statutes requiring them to report on data, and they require our data to do that. So we've just gone through an extensive process of reviewing that whole, their request, and reviewing all the statutes, and making sure that we can give them that and still follow the FERPA requirements and follow other laws. So it takes a long time to do this because we do follow a lot of rules. But essentially, it's similar to the IRB process.
So we're talking about vendor characteristics and how they store and encrypt data. Mm-hmm. So when we think of the PII information, that's not part of that. Is that right? Because that comes directly from an agency. You know,
right.
In other words, I was just trying to read up on this issue because it's such a hot button with the topic, you know. With the public, the testing action plan, the global education futures plan, the whole digital badging piece. I mean, that doesn't fall under this discussion because these aren't vendors, which is why I was bringing in these other initiatives. I'm not sure who funds them, but I mean, they're all wanting data and they're linking data. So, does any of this discussion shed light on that for the public, or how can we? Do we need a study session on this to unpack it further, or you know? Like I said, a lot of times in these presentations we get siloed information, which is helpful.
Right.
But the public is trying to connect the dots as we are and trying to figure out the safety of data.
So Dr. Scheffel, if I may, we have attempted to increase the transparency to the public on the agreements that we have in place, and we basically have two categories, the third-party vendor contracts, and then we're developing a model data sharing agreement that implements the same type of rigorous privacy and security requirements for nonprofit, other state agencies, other researchers who might be doing the research and wanting the data.
So
and
tell
those
me
are
that
passed, posted to the website.
So could you just say that again, third-party vendor contracts?
Third-party vendor
contracts.
So what's
an example of a third-party vendor? Is it like Amplify or something?
Listed on the website. They basically are vendors that are procured and retained by the department. Mm-hmm. They go through the state contracting process, and they use a state contract.
Okay.
We've developed new privacy and security language for those, and they are paid with state funds, usually to perform a function mandated by law, typically. And then there are data sharing agreements, which are sometimes they're required by law, but there's no money changing hands. We have several with, we have one with the Human Services, Department of Human Services. Higher Ed is one that we've looked at. And so we are in the process of, you know, strengthening the privacy and security requirements in these data exchanges with even with other state agencies to address some of these concerns. And then they're posted to the website, and I think we've committed to coming back and giving you a detailed update on the data sharing agreements, what data is being collected, why, for what, and for what purpose, what is the outcome of the data exchange.
So are those the two leverage, the two areas to look at carefully, the third-party vendor contracts, which is partly what we're doing now, am I right?
Uh-huh.
And then the data sharing agreements, which does bring in other governmental agencies, whether state or federal, right?
That's correct.
And those data sharing agreements, are you halfway through the transparency piece where you're listing links? I mean, where are we with making that? I mean, what parents want to know in the public, how many data points are there?
Mm-hmm.
On what kids for what reason? What is it? Who's it shared with? For what purpose? Aggregated, disaggregated? How hard to hack into it? I mean, the same questions you'd be asking if someone were looking at your data are the same questions the parents are asking on behalf of their kids. So where are we with that?
Actually, those the one that we just signed with Higher Ed, that's the most up-to-date one, and we do have a strong set of requirements in there. We've beefed that one up since we've been discussing with you over the last few months. So that one is actually pretty strong. We'll take a look at that when we come back in December, so you can see it as an example. And each time every one of those comes up for renewal, we do the same thing. We look at it, see if it needs to be updated, see if we need to add some more provisions to it, and we do that as we move forward.
So on the website, that agreement was approved October 22nd, 2015. We list the contract, the data sharing agreement, who it's with, the date it was approved. We give a brief description of its purpose. They share data for the purpose of conducting educational studies to develop, validate, or administer predictive tests. And then there's a hyperlink where you can actually pull up the contract, the data sharing agreement itself, and look at it. So as these data sharing agreements come up for renewal and are updated, we're putting them on the website, and that's on the data privacy website that's open to the public.
Do you feel like when you read those that people can understand what it really means? I mean, because I've looked at some of that, and I'm thinking, the question the public has is pretty hard to sort through.
We're trying to be a lawyer.
Yeah. We're trying to make it more user-friendly because, you know, I'm kind of an outsider coming in. I'm not very familiar with these programs, so if I can't understand it, then the common parent's not going to understand it. Whereas people that have worked with these programs for many years really understand it. So we're working on that. We're working to put it in different places and in different formats so that it is more understandable by the public. And so I think we do have some slides that are going to go over, you know, what we have done, because we've made a lot of changes to the website in the last few months to make it more user-friendly in response to comments from the board and other members of the public of what data is being collected for what purpose.
Okay, and can I ask one more follow-up?
Yes, please.
So, you know, for example, we just passed the waiver today for NCLB, and under that waiver we are including many thousands of more students whose data I think the feds get in that part of that waiver, because it was just Title I schools and Title I students. Now we've opened it up to more students. So now that just passed today. Is that something you look at then and say, okay, how are we going to get this data, encrypt this data, share this data, for how long, under what, you know, I mean, how does it travel through the system, at rest, not at rest? Well, I mean, how do you keep up with all those implications whenever we...
Correct me if I'm wrong. We've been told that the federal government does not get any personally identified information.
Mm-hmm. And yet they're identifying X number of students for whom the waiver to whom the waiver applies. So how would they even know that then?
Can I aggregate?
We would know, but they wouldn't necessarily. If they're getting averages, or scores that are not tied to any individual.
Mm-hmm.
So we still stand by no personally identifiable information is being sent to the federal government. For Title I or any other reason?
For any purpose. Yeah.
Okay. It's just aggregate reporting that does not identify a student.
Okay.
And then, Mr.
Chair. Ms. Rankin.
Are you
finished? Thank you.
How many different vendors are we dealing with here at CDE?
That are involved with PII?
Not necessarily.
That's a big number. We could get that for you.
14 probably.
These are 14 are PII,
just
and then
PII.
There are a bunch
just
more
PII.
That are not.
Yeah, that are not PII.
I'd like to get that number,
okay,
but it's not urgent. Second question is, how many unique software programs are we dealing with?
That we run or?
That are somewhere come into this building.
I can get that for you.
Right.
I don't want to guess at that
one. The third question is, any of these vendors, are you aware of any policies where there are backdoor policies in place with them where they or their software shares data and it has nothing to do with the conversations we've been having?
Our contracts prohibit that sort of functionality, so I'm not aware of any.
So between your vendor and you,
yes,
that's where we stand. But between
mm-hmm.
the vendor and outside, we really don't know that.
We don't have any real control over it. However, we do try to we do put the requirements that we place on vendors. We require our vendors to place on their third-party providers as well. We obviously can't control that, But it's a requirement.
Thank you.
But that is why that last function up on the timeline, the audit execution, is so important, is that if we suspect or just to keep the vendor honest, we're hoping to get the funding and the resources to go out and actually audit the vendor and make sure that they're complying with the terms of the contract, and that's why that function is so important. But it's a ways off. We just don't have the resources to do that right now, but we're hoping to develop the resources and expertise to do that.
Thank you.
Additional questions? I have a couple. At the education conference, several of us attended last week or 2 weeks ago. I think time flies when you're having fun. I attended the data privacy piece of that, and on the panel was a legislator from Georgia, and their legislation was being touted as something that had been successful, and Representative Lundeen was able to ask a question. The question was, how many data fields do you allow to be collected? And the answer, of course, some legislators would know, but the legislator didn't know. It turns out his technology officer was in the room. The answer was 1,100. I didn't bother to read that bill because I figured somehow it missed the point. And so I think in these contracts, what the absolute minimum, and I don't know how you go about it, although I have a suggestion. You require every vendor that has access to or collects this data to identify by field what information they collect. And then you take a red pencil and say, you don't need this, you don't need this, you can't collect that. And you start cutting this down to educationally necessary data. And if we're not doing that at step one, if you're not demanding as a part of this contract what data you collect, and if you're not going through it with a red pen and saying you can't have this, you can't have that, and because 1,100 is, unless I misunderstand what a data field is, it's just a tad too many. I don't see phase one on here. It looks like to me you're dealing with data, with protection of data, but I think has been pointed out over and over today, the only secure data is that which you don't collect. Everything else is vulnerable to hacking and other methods of it getting out. So the first defense is for you all to bring these contracts up to standard by insisting they tell you what they're collecting, and you, the contractor, whoever approves these contracts, goes through it with very careful eye and takes out everything that's not absolutely necessary for the accomplishment of, and generally speaking, if it's not required by statute, there's no reason to collect it. So we need to get that under control first. The second part then is to deal with how you protect what has in fact already been collected. And so I think it's a two-phase process, and it doesn't appear to me we're putting enough emphasis on the first phase. I would certainly like to see, and a couple other things. They have to be absolutely transparent with the public about the data they do collect. There's no such thing as it's proprietary what they're collecting, which is one of the defenses they use over at the Capitol. That defense won't work here. It's not proprietary. It cannot be proprietary. It's our data on our children. They can't collect it without our approval, and they have to disclose what it is, and they have to disclose it to the parents as well. Mm-hmm. Those are the provisions that need to be in these contracts, which is a lot of work if you have 14 contracts. And I don't think it's a negotiable item. In your bid document, you need to be very specific that this is the minimum, and if you don't want to bid on this basis, don't bid it. And we need these contracts out, rebid, we need to start holding all these people accountable. And if we can get that done, then we'll be done here. What they do across the street from there on out is up to them, but we'll have done what we can do. And it seems to me that we're just not quite hitting the mark on this. And I think also then Dr. Scheffel's questions are very, really go down a whole different issue, and that is federal government, state government, private researchers, on what's the statutory requirement that we give anybody any data. I think the fact that the two bureaucracies agree that it ought to be exchanged is inadequate. That decision has to come up for, to those of us who make the heat, or who are going to take the heat. So if we're going to take heat for sharing with Department of Corrections, it needs to be brought here for a vote, and we'll decide, unless it's statutorily mandated, whether or not we'll give them that information. And that's true with higher ed. That it, unless there's a solid statutory mandate, I expect those data sharing arrangements to come here for a vote, that we're either going to agree to that data sharing or we're not going to agree to it, because I don't want to be held responsible for that which I have no control. So, and right now, we're people on this dais are being held responsible for two bureaucrats agreeing to trade data, and that's not going to cut it any longer. So I don't want to hear about any more agreements being approved with higher ed or anybody else until they're brought here with the demonstration of statutory authority that, A, we have to, and we won't vote on those, but if it's optional, we're going to make a decision. So the bureaucracy needs to be on notice. This is not your decision anymore. This is unfortunately, because of everybody's concern, been elevated one level higher. So I hope that message is clear, because we don't want to go down this road anymore. So I don't want to hear about any more agreements being approved with anybody without them being brought here for data sharing. Further questions or anything from the members of the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much, and I appreciate what you're doing, and keep trying. We've got a long way to go. Let's see if we can get there. We're now, where are we? We are now on individual board members' report. Do we just want to start with Pam and come around the table, activities you've attended, things you've done, I presume, questions you may have. We'll just go all the way around.
Discussion. We could do it tomorrow, if that's okay.
You want to do it tomorrow?
Yeah.
You would like to lay over your request for graduation line? Okay. So that would mean the...
Just 10 minutes, maybe not take a break.
You want to do it today, you say?
No.
Oh, tomorrow.
Why not?
We definitely have time.
We always do it at the end of the day.
Okay, you want to do it tomorrow. We'll work it in tomorrow's agenda. Pam, you want to start?
The most important event I attended was the Excellence in Education Summit here in Denver. As usual, it was very good. I would like to mention the school board elections and just personally make a statement that I think that the conduct leading up to the local school board elections is yet another reason why school choice is the answer, in my opinion. If parents were allowed to take the funds allotted for their child's education to the school of their choice, public or private, perhaps school board elections would not be such high stakes.
Anything else?
That's it.
Joyce?
I went to the West Slope Superintendents meeting held in Grand Junction and met a lot of superintendents in very, very small school districts and some that were medium size. It was very interesting to me. I went to the CASB Fall Conference here and listened to two JBC members talk to them about finance and the budget for the upcoming year, which is rather depressing. But I also attended the National Education Summit on Educational Reform. And a really exciting visit I had was in Basalt when Letitia Guzman Ingram received the Teacher of the Year Award. She's an English language development teacher, and was at an assembly with all of the students in the school. It was pretty exciting. I guess I've heard she'll be here in January to receive the award here. And I visited the Aspen Community School. It's a charter school. Sky Skinner's a principal, or superintendent, rather. It was really interesting to see one of the best schools that had a unique building, and you could have heard a pin drop in that whole building, which was very surprising to me. But every kid, when we went in every classroom, they were working. It was pretty interesting. So that was my last month.
Jane?
The week some of you were at the Summit. Angelica and I shared our time with NASB's annual conference, wherein I think there was an awful lot of parallel overlap around the topics discussed and reports given. Among them, there was discussion about technology, where we also spent a lot of time on things around data privacy and in the sense of taking, changing lanes. And we had that, the idea of changing lanes and yet tying that in with all of the movement and activity around the SEA reauthorization and what does the future look like in all kinds of different scenarios. So it's, you know, like we are here a lot of times, until we know something, it's hard to know something. So as we wait this decision. But that was great. Angelica, and I will take the liberty of announcing, Angelica is our new Western Region Director on the National Association of State Boards of Education Board. So Angelica has taken over my former position as representing the 11 states in the Western Region of the country that are members of NASB. And very happy to still have Colorado's voice in our state board circles about the things that we talk about and can influence and work toward good policy all the way around. So have to on that. Two other real quick things. I've also, I was on a couple of panels, and as it so happened, both were on the same day. So it was a lot of talky and drivey all day long. But one of them was the Adams 12 Leadership Academy. A lot of school districts around the state have developed and are building on leadership academies, and this is for the adults. So there can be community members or staff members, teachers, people in the education interest areas. There are more and more of them all the time. A very great opportunity for communities to learn deeply about the school systems. And there's no topic that's really eliminated or left out. You have to pare down a curriculum, so to speak, because of time. But all the types and forms of our schools are given a chance to present and for people to learn about. And I talked along with some of the almost elected city officials. So we were interact with cities and other local government bodies. It's always a good opportunity to sit down. And I attended a Shape Colorado, which is part of the Living Well coalition groups that are around the state on covering and talking and caring about such things as good nutrition. Of course, those conversations happen in our schools too. Wellness, family, community wellness, projects for schools and communities to do in that area. So it's been a learning month for me, and much appreciated.
Well, I guess I can say ditto. St. Vrain has had a leadership, St. Vrain parent and community group for actually a number of years, and we had our panel discussion in which I participated with the St. Vrain representatives in our legislature, and it was a very interesting discussion. Last night I was in Poudre. It was not a community leadership, but we did the legislative representatives, and I did speak with the school board and school staff about what they wanted to see in legislation and what we thought was coming forward. I attended with Steve and Joyce the Questar Standardized Assessment meeting, which I thought was interesting because it was an opportunity to hear from yet another vendor in terms of potential assessments. Didn't look all that different. I think it's been helpful. I think the three of us also attended a Charter School Policy and Facility Summit. I went with Jane to the SHAPE conference. They're very helpful because we tend to hear a fair amount from in the field. I also attended the STEM Summit, which was really interesting, and I wasn't really sure for a while who were the participants, but most of the participants were school folks, either teachers or administrators who were trying to implement STEM. But there were also a lot of community people, there were business people. It was an excellent one-day conference. I think that's about all. The NASB conference was interesting. I think the one little really little bitty gem that I heard about in the data discussions were a state, I think it was a state, that had an agreement that teachers had to give to any vendors when they purchased materials, so that the vendor had to agree to certain steps. And it was sort of a way to, one of the things we talk about is that even in the classroom level, we worry a little bit about data security and data privacy. And here was a sort of a little pro forma that was expected that a teacher would require from the vendor before they would use it and include any data. I thought that was something for us to talk about as we keep working on it. That was one little glimmer. See, tomorrow I'm going to be going up to Frisco to meet in St. Vrain with, I think it's a town hall meeting about education, higher ed, and some local education, and it's going to be largely about rural education.
Deborah?
I have presented and attended a conference on online learning and always interested in seeing how technology can be used to best effect in education, and also look forward to the PEBC Superintendent Forum tomorrow.
Val?
I have attended about three schools, a couple of charter schools up in the Northwest Green Valley Ranch in Denver. I also attended a meeting of educators on adult education, and at which I got kind of really informed as to the testing. They just don't feel that that this new GED test that's made up by Pearson is really helping educators. In fact, they thought that only 80%, 80% of the people were failing it. And that they weren't doing well, and that they felt that we should really think about opening it up not only to Pearson but to the other two that are giving more options, more choices to adult educators on this. It was a very interesting meeting with these educators, and I was glad that they invited me to hear their report on what they thought should be happening, and that seriously, the loud and clear was, don't narrow it, open it up to more choices, so that people can take this test. Also, I attended the CASB conference, and I thought it was interesting, especially the first one where we had a couple of legislators talk about how they were going to solve the crisis. I call it a crisis in funding in Colorado for education. Also, I attended the joint education study, a group at the legislature where they brought in experts and discussed violence in schools. And a big portion of that, believe it or not, was about privacy. And I read widely, and I came to this conclusion, and especially after hearing those people, talking to other people, because I started asking questions. And I think a lot of this data collection maybe indeed to find out why we have, what people are to predict, seriously, not to really get everybody on board to be competent and have a great life experience and work experience, which I think that's what education is about. But it's more about, can we predict who's going to be a murderer? And this is from several journals in sociology, and also the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times. And it seems as if that's a very important question. Can we, because they really don't know. They want a theory on why we have these people, these young people who go out and shoot people. The New Yorker article was very informative in stating that they think it has to do with a mob. And that was sort of interesting, that a mob takes its own kind of form, and then individuals do their kind of violence or their thing in when they get into that mentality. And in a sense, we have that with all this reporting that's going on and everybody tuning in to it. But I thought that was interesting. I mean, that my reading has been towards that. But the privacy part of that joint was very important too, as to are we stepping on toes when we want to collect all this data, and sort of the issues that we've been discussing here. Are we collecting too much? Are we, and should we be doing that? Also, I did meet with a legislator who wanted to talk to me about what we were thinking concerning education, testing, evaluation, and accountability. And then I met with several people who are concerned about those issues that we've been discussing, testing, accountability. There was a group of people that actually thought that we shouldn't be taking the money, the ESA money, that we should just say no to the feds and go about our business of teaching and learning. That's it.
Okay. Couple of things I'd like to introduce. We have some guests, Representative Tim Doerr and Representative Bob Rankin in the back of the room, all in their legislative outfits of dark coats and red ties. It's like, I hope did all your colleagues get the memo over there for today? I think everything, the meetings I attended were largely covered by others, I think with the exception, and several of us were there. I think it was the Colorado Succeeds lunch with Governor Engler and Governor Hickenlooper speaking about standards and accountability in workforce development, which was interesting. I think, you know, long on objective, short on substance in both instances. I would like then to talk a little bit about our schedule coming up. Tomorrow we'll meet at 9:30, and we have a very heavy schedule starting. We have a special meeting on the 19th, which this may double as the update on the commissioner search, where we will get a report and I think have an opportunity. That will be an executive session to go through, and it'll be in this room, go through applications, try and sort those down and see if we can cut that down to a list of people that we might want to interview. We won't get all the way to finalists, but I think that's the plan, to try and get that far in one day. It could be a long day. I'm not, having not been through this before, it's difficult to tell. So we'll juggle that schedule for all day on, I think that's a Thursday, the 19th, as I recall, for that meeting. Please adjust your calendars. We did adjust the interviews to the 9th and 10th.
7th and 8th.
To the 7th and 8th of December from the 1st, and I think they were scheduled for the 30th and the 1st. So we moved those to a week later, and then a week after that, if we still need another meeting, to make a final selection. So I think that's the rough schedule. Yes.
I ask how many people, how many applicants we have?
I don't know the answer to that, because I think applications, have they closed?
Yes.
They just closed, and I have not talked to, I've not spoken with the search firm, so I can't give you an answer to that question. How many completed applications they had, I think they expected a fairly significant number, and 40 to 60. We'll see if they made that number. I don't know.
Thank you.
And that would be the end of this report. And I think then the only other item of business, do we have any more public comment, Elizabeth? We have three individuals that have indicated they want to make comments. Chris Carter. Is Chris here? Looks like we... Okay. Terry Jones. Maybe easier than it looks. Chelsea Hinkle. Hinkle, right? Did I get that right?
You did.
Thank you. All right.
Might just be me wrapping up here.
It's you.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment here today. I'm actually going to talk to you just a little bit about something that's on the agenda for you all for tomorrow, and that's the State Board Educator, I'm sorry, it's the Rule Alignment for the Educator Preparation and Licensing Rules that are coming up for you all tomorrow. My name is Chelsea Hinkle, and I'm the policy manager at Stand for Children. We're a nonprofit education advocacy organization, and our mission is to ensure that all children, regardless of their background, are prepared for life after high school and have access to a college education. I just want to let you all know that we really support the proposed rules changes that are coming before you tomorrow. I know you've heard a little bit about them before, and we wanted to come up and just tell you how much we appreciate the CDE and especially the Educator Preparation and Licensing Unit for undertaking this really important work. They did a tremendous amount of work, as you all saw in the 300 pages that they had. And they engaged in a really thoughtful and thorough stakeholder engagement process. They had a lot of feedback. They're really opening to hearing a lot of conversations and engaging in a lot of feedback with stakeholders. As you all know, in recent years, the legislature has adopted many important and positive changes that impact the expectations for educators, and it subsequently impacts the expectations for the preparation programs that would prepare educators to go into classrooms here in our state. Unfortunately, as statute was changing, the rules for educator preparation programs were not keeping up, and they, as a result, became pretty woefully outdated. The resulting lack of alignment between the rules and statutes was really pretty problematic and had some serious impacts on whether or not new teachers were prepared to enter the classroom and to meet the changing demands of their profession. My organization took the opportunity to meet with some prep programs throughout the state, and what we kept hearing from them was that this misalignment that was happening between rule and statute was really causing some stress for them, some contradictions, and in particular, we asked them about the READ Act. And the misalignment between a statute for the READ Act and then the rules that were in the preparation program requirements were actually in some places very contradictory. And so prep programs were unaware of how they could reconcile these differences. So we're really pleased that as advocates for early literacy and supporters of the READ Act, this misalignment was fixed. And we're also pleased that the new rules correct many other highly problematic misalignments that existed beforehand. So we appreciate that the rules changes create consistency throughout our state-level teacher prep regulations, and they provide clarity to institutions of higher ed, and I believe to all of you as members of the state board, about what content expectations the state has for new teachers and teacher prep programs. So again, just wanted to thank the CDE for all the work that they did, tell you about our support for the new rules, and we look forward to the next phase of the licensing revision process and the opportunity to participate in future discussions regarding the content assessments for teacher candidates.
Thank you very much. Any other business to come before the board at this time? Did we miss anything, Elizabeth?
No.
All right. We'll be adjourned until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning.